Hello, and welcome to the second season of Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is best-selling romance author Ginger Scott, whose new novel, Wicked Restless, is out now. I'm happy to welcome her to the show. Ginger, thanks for coming on Covered.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and talk today.
Oh, excellent. So your new book is Wicked Restless, and I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about the book.
Sure. Wicked Restless is actually a follow-up. I kind of call it a companion novel rather than a series because they stand on their own, and I don't think you need to read them in order, though I would love people to read them in order. The first one before it was Wild Reckless, and both of them are kind of mature young adult novels set in the Midwest and in Woodstock, Illinois. And they really focus on what happens when you grow up in a house that's maybe impacted by how people see mental illness. Both of these two brothers that are in each book are impacted by that and sort of the opinions that people put on them, and they see them as sort of bad seeds. And of course, it's a romance, so there's a girl in each story. And in Wicked Restless, it's Andrew's story. He's the younger brother, and there's a girl that kind of sees beyond the rumors for who they really are and helps pull them maybe out of their shell. Of course, we don't want them to get too comfortable, so life happens, and I like to find maybe some painful things in life that can happen just to see how people pull their way through it. I like to see adversity and how we succeed.
Can you read a little bit from either of the books?
I sure will. I would love to. I'm going to give you a little passage from the new one, which is Wicked Restless. And this book is kind of unique in that I started it. The first part focuses on when they were teenagers, when they're 16, which is, you know, when we're all awkward when we're in love. And then I fast forward after something happens between the couple 5 years later to kind of revisit them in college. So this is when they're teenagers. And this is when Andrew, the main character, kind of is first getting to know Emma, the girl in the story, and they're getting to know each other through PE class in the awkward square dancing unit that we've all had to go through. The only bonus about today, we don't have to wear our uniforms. We get a break for the entire week. In fact, it's the square dancing unit. For about 10 minutes, we've been sitting in the gym, our backs flush against the wall outside our locker room, while Mr. Crest struggles with an ancient sound system. Based on the few times he was able to get the speakers to make a sound, I'm pretty sure we're not missing anything by not hearing this music. He finally turns the microphone on and sets it next to a tiny speaker he plugs into his phone. "All right, gentlemen, on your feet and form a line against the wall," he says. There's a collective grumble as we stand. But that sound stops as soon as the girls' locker room's door swings open and a single file line that matches ours begins to fill the space along the other wall. When I see Emma, I start counting. She's in the middle, and I make it to 14 before the row of girls streaming through the door ends. I count two more times to be sure, and then I count my own line. 17, three people away. Our number 14 is a guy whose pants are rolled up at the bottom, and the dude isn't wearing socks. He isn't worthy of Emma, but he notices her. I watch him count, and I watch him clench his fist in a silent yes when he's got it figured out. There is no way I am letting this asshole swing her around the gym floor to shitty music for 45 minutes. "Dude," I say, leaning forward, watching to make sure Mr. Crest is still facing the front. "Psst, dude." Fucker's ignoring me. "Come on, hey, man." He finally looks my way. He's wearing a button-down shirt. The collar is wrinkled. "Hey, trade me spots." "Fuck off," he shrugs. I blink at him, a little stunned that he was so quick to shut me down. Owen would have punched him, or saved this memory for later and made him suffer through ridicule. Or he'd just date the guy's girlfriend. I glance back down to his shoes and his hairy ankles. I'm pretty sure he doesn't have a girlfriend. I look at my row again, making sure I didn't mess up on the first count. I'm still 17. I glance back at sockless dude, and he's tucking his shirt in and smoothing his hair out on the sides. I cannot believe he's going to touch Emma's arm. Our lines move forward, and couples are pairing off and finding spots on the gym floor marked with tape. When I'm about 10 people away, I count again, relieved that at least I have a shy girl who looks just as comfortable with this lesson as I do. The music is mostly fiddle, and there's a male singer giving directions, spinning two steps in, two steps out, around the barn, and ain't she pretty. I laugh a little under my breath. It's my turn to pair off when I glance back up and meet Emma's eyes. I don't show my surprise, and I ignore the grunts in protest of the a-hole two people away from me. "Dude, socks, if you just wore socks, this would not have happened." Maybe it would have, though. Maybe. Maybe Emma was counting two. I guide her to our tape marks on the far corner, and while everyone else has unlinked arms, I keep my hold on hers. Our elbows locked together. The soft tickle of her skin along mine is possibly the best thing that has happened to me in my life to date. I lean over and whisper in her ear while we wait for the remaining couples to find their spot. The dude doesn't wear socks. She laughs the most perfect, quiet, careful laugh, then glances over her shoulder as sockless guy walks by with his partner. Yeah, thanks for saving me from that, she giggles. I nod and smile, but while we sit down in our square formation, I also feel a little smug. You had to trade spots with three people, Emma. This wasn't just about the socks.
So before you had started reading, you mentioned that something happens between the two main characters that were introduced to them, and then something happens, and I had tweeted this to you after reading it, because I was very angry at this thing that happened. And I'm not going to go into what happened, because I don't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't read it. But other romance novels I've read, and I haven't read a lot, but the ones I've read usually allow both the two love interests and the reader to sort of enjoy the relationship for a little bit before throwing something major at them. Right. And you decided to flip that on its head and throw something major at them before they've even had a chance to really get off the ground. Why did you do that?
You know, I have a couple of reasons. The first one is I try to write as real as possible. I really like the sense of realism in stories. And sometimes life's timeline doesn't play by the rules. So I kind of wanted to toy with that a little bit. And also there's that certain element when you're young and you're a teenager, everything feels so real and it feels like so much more and it moves fast. You fall for someone and you fall really quickly. I mean, many of us probably look back and you can think of like 20 times that you thought you were in love with someone, or, you know, you might have been in love with them that night at the party when you first saw them and you danced with them. And then years later, you realize maybe it wasn't. But these two characters were kind of meeting each other at a time when they were both probably pretty lonely and kind of were desperate for that other person that would understand who they were and would get them. And then I just thought it would be kind of an interesting thing to watch to see what happened if right when they were finally feeling good together, if maybe we ripped them apart.
You mentioned realism when writing these books, and I know you had spoken about some characters having mental illness. Some characters in this book deal with physical ailments, you know, medically diagnosed and operable things going on in their lives. Does that come from personal life?
A little bit of everything. Before I ventured into the waters of fiction, my previous life, I was a journalist, and there were a lot of different things that I covered that definitely influenced my stories. I think they influence probably the way I write and the way I kind of describe scenes and put the color in a story. But there were certain stories that I've covered that just made an impact. And in fact, one of the things that you mentioned in Wicked Restless actually comes from a story I heard on NPR that kind of made a mark and left an impression on me. And I thought to myself, that is a really interesting, maybe scary thing that happens for real. I'm going to tuck that away in my head because I think that would make an interesting novel one day.
So you never stop being a journalist, it sounds like.
No, I don't.
How much research went into the novel?
A lot. A friend of mine from high school actually is a doctor, and she sent me a lot of white papers on various medical things that I needed to kind of research and other options and avenues I thought about going down, to the point where I was once again grateful that I did not study science in college, that I studied journalism and hyphens and commas, because it was a lot of biology. But definitely a lot of research there. And I also was fortunate in finding a blog by a family who was going through something similar to what I was writing about. And I started following it along with my writing process.
You know, you weave a lot of realism into your books, but one of the basic tenets of romance novels is that there's always a happy ending, that, you know, no matter what happens, no matter how much tragedy strikes your characters, it always has to have a happy ending. Do you find that there's a struggle there between inserting realism where there might not always be a happy ending and then making sure it has to have that happy ending?
Absolutely. That's a great question. You know, it's funny. I, along with millions of others, do love the Jane Austen world. And, you know, that's her thing. All of her women will have happy endings. And, you know, the guy and the girl, they get each other in the end. A lot of us read to escape and we like to feel good when we're done. But there is a part of me that really loves the idea of things being messy. I'm very attracted to the things, the content that I consume, to some bleak stories. One of my favorite books ever of all time is The Great Gatsby. And I think I love it so much because it is a really unhappy love story. and I admire the bravery it took to write that. But, you know, it just feels good to have a happy ending too. So maybe one day down the road, I will not have one. But for now, I'm enjoying the credits rolling with everyone feeling happy with smiles on their faces.
It's funny. Your book is one of maybe two I can think of that have been able to, within a few pages, take me back to 15 years ago. I'm 15 years old. I'm in high school and, you know, there's a girl and I have these feelings and these hormones rushing through me. I think Eleanor and Park is maybe the only other book I can think of that actually did that to me. How do you find that voice? How do you find a way to really capture everything going on in that part of a person's life?
You know, this is funny, and my mom would probably agree with this. I think maybe there's a part of me that never grew up past that point. She used to tell me that I had a flair for the melodrama when I was that age. So maybe I bottled some of it up. I'm a big observer. I observe a lot. I like to watch just behaviors, and you know, I'm the person at the mall when I'm eating lunch in the food court, kind of watching people. I watch how the group of girls at the table tries to get the attention of the group of guys at the other table. Just the little kind of nuances and things people do. But you know, I am surrounded by a lot of youth. My son is almost 12, so he's getting to that very awkward, uncomfortable stage. But it's what I've always been attracted to in terms of stories too. I'm a John Hughes girl. I grew up, you know, wanting to be Molly Ringwald. So I think there's a part of me that's always chasing that too.
Romance novels seem to have, at least from what I've seen, a strong draw toward the bad boy. Why is that? What is so appealing about the guy who has those rough edges?
And I have a couple of possibilities on why that's the case. I think on some level, it's fun to have this little fantasy about the taboo. That's certainly why we love the vampire stories, because a vampire is terribly taboo, you know, not really a good idea to get in a relationship with, yet happens over and over and over again. And the bad boy is more of the realism side of taboo. And maybe there is some truth to deep down, we all want to try to be the helper and the one to fix them. But I think there's a certain appeal to being the one to break the bad boy. And when you read a romance novel, at least for me, when I read a romance novel, I really like to kind of immerse myself into it and see things through the eyes of the character I'm reading. And I become that girl. I become that person. And to think that I'm the one who is the only one that gets him, or the only one that can change him, or can help him climb out of whatever darkness he's in, it feels good. It's empowering, because perhaps in the rest of your life, that's not the case.
Right, right. Where specifically do young adult and new adult romance novels fall on the, I don't want to say success spectrum, but for example, according to the Romance Writers of America, 84% of romance readers are women, and the trend is that 70% of them discover the genre between 11 and 18, and most of the romance readers now tend to be on the older side, between 30 and 54. So where do your novels fall in terms of readership? You know, the genre as a whole, new adult, which has gained proliferation, especially with the rise of self-publishing. You know, how have things grown? How have things changed? You know, is that still true? Do you find that most romance readers, in your experience, are of the older side, or more people getting involved in discovering romance novels at a younger age?
Yeah, I would say so. At some events that I've been to and some signings, I get people that come to visit my table to talk to me about my books that are 14 or 15. My first series that I wrote is very high school. It actually follows a couple through 4 years of high school. And I will talk to a lot of, you know, younger readers about that. But then I'm surprised because then I'll turn around and I'll have a senior citizen in her 60s come to my table who read the very same story. And she loved that it took her back to that time when she was young, when she was 17, 18, you know, awkward and uncomfortable and everything was new and the first heartbreak and all of those firsts. I think maybe I at least have been able to find a path because there's a common thread. No matter what age I'm writing about, we've all kind of been there. We've all gone through this. We've all had the first kiss. We've all had the first kiss that went badly, or we've all pined right after the person that didn't love us back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's N-A-C-H-T sound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. Going based off of that question about the growth of romance, you know, going to BookCon this last year, Harlequin had one of the largest booths I've ever seen at a convention before. So there was talk recently of a romance-only bookstore being opened somewhere. Romance is a multi-billion dollar industry. Why do you think there's been so much growth in what used to be considered, and depending on the circles you run in, might still be considered, you know, this fluffy fast food type literary meal for people? Obviously, there's more than what a lot of people believe about romance novels and romance authors and romance readers, that's not just fluff. But why has there been such this staggering growth in the genre?
You know, I think there are, and I think if you looked back at books, certainly if I went out to my living room to the bookcase of, you know, books that my husband and I have both collected over 20 years, and I pulled some things from the shelves, I think I would probably pull a few books down that maybe before weren't considered romance novels. But the reason I loved those books were because they had a love story thread through them. And so I think there has been sort of an expansion beyond that traditional historical romance that you know, perhaps stereotypically we're all used to seeing. It's more than just that. And I love historical romance as well, but it's not just that anymore. It's romance, you know, playing out in a sports field. It's romance in business. It's romance in real life. And I think the contemporary side of things is partly something that has helped maybe romance break out of that shell that it was perceived to be in. Certainly, I think a lot of people feel really proud of saying that they're romance readers. I am a hardcore romance reader. It's always my first choice of book. And when I read things that my husband is reading, I ask him first, am I going to like it? Is there a love story in it? And if there's a love story in it, then I'll give it a try. That's what I loved about Divergent. I love the story, but I love the love story a little bit more. But I think that sort of expansion and breaking into a contemporary world has helped. And I would be remiss by not saying that 50 Shades of Grey did not have an impact. When a book does something and it hits that big and it everyone knows it and it's noticed everywhere, I think people start to pay attention to the genre that surrounds it.
Now, on the other side of that, you have the people who, there was that article on the Huffington Post from several months ago, and maybe even last year, that basically said romance readers are reading silly fluff and romance novels aren't worth reading. And that kind of opinion crops up all the time. Why do you think romance takes such flack, that it takes such a hit from other people?
You know, I'm not sure why. I think maybe it's because it's so big, and it's big. It's, you know, all those numbers that you mentioned before and all, right. You know. Opening its very own book.
It's cool to hate it kind of thing.
It's cool to hate it. Yeah. And that could be, they are books about feelings, and you know, it's not for everyone. And that's okay too. It doesn't have to be for everyone. You know, it's funny. My mom gave me this really great piece of advice once, because she's actually like one of two people on earth that don't like Brad Pitt. So she said, you know, things aren't for everyone. And so maybe romance isn't for everyone. And that's all right. But I've read an awful lot of unbelievably gripping, moving stories with delicate language and just beautiful, heartfelt moments kind of woven throughout that have stuck with me, that I will probably remember forever, that are romance books. So maybe they're missing out. Maybe they just haven't found the right book.
I don't know. There's this myth that romance readers lack romance in real life. And maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's the people who are dissing romance who lack the romance in real life.
Maybe. If they want to email me, I would be happy to give them recommendations.
Now, I'm going to spin it around to the writing side of things, and let's just dive into it. You decided long ago, you've got 8 books under your belt, to self-publish. Now, are all of your books self-published?
They are so far.
Okay. And what was the choice behind that?
I will be brutally bluntly honest. This is me, as with many writers, this is my dream. It's what I always wanted to do. But I was terrified to the point of paralysis of rejection. And I think it's okay to admit that. And I think it's okay to say it and embrace it, because rejection feels bad.
And it does.
No one really loves rejection. And, you know, we all talk about it in this industry, because it is a part of the industry, because there are so many people that hunger and want this. It's their dream, and it's a wonderful dream. And only so many people can get through the door. And I understand that. And I understand that about the business, but that kind of paralyzed me for a while. And so I carried around this half written manuscript for far more years than I should admit, but let's just say that we could round it off around a decade, because I was terrified of what I would have to do after I finished it. And then I had read about a few people that found success in self-publishing. And finally, one year, my husband told me, because I make a goal list every year, and I said, this is the year I finish my book, like I say every year. And he said, you know what the only thing holding you back is? And I said, what? And he said, actually writing the damn thing. And I said, oh, that is a good point.
That's the hard part, yeah.
The hard part. So I finished it, and I got to that point, and he said, let's just try it. And he said, worst case scenario, you know, your 17 friends and relatives read it, and then you can say you've done it and you're done, and, you know, cross that off the bucket list. And I said, okay. And so I did it. And then, you know, 17 people found it. And then the next week, 17 people found it. And then the next week, 18. And then it just kind of grassroots grew from there. And I thought, wow, I just skipped a whole layer of rejection.
Yeah.
And it was empowering, and it felt good. And so I kind of chugged along. I did this backwards, you know, from the traditional way. And I chugged along that way, understanding the marketing and learning the ins and outs. And I have, you know, a background in graphics and digital media. So that helped me a lot along the way, because I really did do everything myself. But it got to the point where now I'm opening up the avenues and maybe entertaining the idea of being what we like to call kind of a hybrid author, someone that works with a traditional house. And maybe I have things that I do independently and some things that I also publish through the traditional houses.
I can understand, if you were afraid of rejection from an agent or a publisher, why you'd want to self-publish. But then once you've self-published, or once you've published your book, yeah, and it's up there,
yep,
you're going to face rejection from readers who didn't like it, you know.
This is true.
or let's say you're in that cesspool of hell known as Goodreads, and right, people don't like it. So what happens there, where you're faced with that kind of rejection, right, where it's actually not as vague as a form letter from an agent saying thanks but no thanks? Now you're getting like people who might be insulting your mother or whoever because they didn't like your book.
Right, it's more like the drive-by egging.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you know, that was scary for me, because it is, and writing is so personal, and you know, there are pieces of me in everything that I put out, and you put it out, and you hold your breath, and you hope, oh God, please, just don't hate it. Just this would be where the conversation about Brad Pitt with my mom came in handy. I was fortunate in that the first book I put out had, from the beginning, more lovers than haters. There were certainly some people that were critical, because I made some choices in that book, which is called Waiting on the Sidelines, where the main guy was kind of a jerk face because teenage boys can sometimes be jerk faces.
Yeah. I was one. We can be.
and you know what? Teenage girls can sometimes make really stupid decisions too. And I addressed that a lot in that book. And that wasn't enjoyable for some people to read. And I now like realize that's wonderful. That's great. And it's not for everyone. And I just want to be for more people than less people. And that's really my goal.
How long did the whole process take for getting the first book that you had done out, from writing to getting it up on online?
Okay, well, we're going to cut off the 10 years where I stalled.
Okay.
So we won't talk about that. But when I actually finally, you know, after my husband told me to get to it, and I sat down and really started writing, I probably spent a good 2.5 months finally cranking out these passages and chapters that I had, you know, in notebooks and various receipts that I'd stuffed into my purse. And I got the book, kind of the framework. And then I probably spent about 2 months having every single journalism friend of mine that I could think of with an editing background edit and read for free. My mother read and, you know, and edited for free, because I went into this with zero seed money. And then I probably spent a couple of weeks going through some learning on how to format and how to make my own cover and the process, what avenue I wanted to go, if I wanted to go just Amazon self-publishing, if I wanted to go to all platform self-publishing. And then once I had all my ducks lined up, I just hit publish. What I did not know, and something that I've since learned, is I did not build in that marketing window the first time. So I hit publish, and then I went. So, I've come a long way, and now I definitely have a more streamlined timeline. And I know when I pick a release date that I have to build in, you know, a good 2 months worth of marketing to make sure that people know about the book before it shows up.
So other than the marketing aspect that had sort of flown under your radar when you first published, what did you do the second time around differently that you had learned from the first time?
The first book I put out a cover that I liked, but it maybe wasn't the most eye-grabbing cover in the world. So I've since actually tweaked the cover on that book to kind of make it reflect the story a little better, make it a little more marketable, a little more eye-catching. So I decided that the second time around, I would spend money. So everything I made on the first book, I would invest in hiring a professional editor, because I love my friends, but we're all AP style. And those of you that are in the journalism world know that AP style is not MLA style.
No, it is not.
No, though I wish it were, because I think AP style is so much easier. I invested in an unbelievable freelance editor who I've worked with on all of my projects now, who I've learned more MLA style from than I ever thought I would. And I invested in a stock photo image for my cover that would kind of make it a little more eye-grabbing. And that's also something I've kind of carried through. I've done a couple of my own photo shoots now for covers.
In the last, I'd say, 5 years, I've seen a shift of people who used to have all of their eggs spread out, diversified across Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, right, you know, as many stores as they could get. And I'm seeing more and more people, at least in my small circle of self-publishers or hybrid publishers, really just focusing on Amazon and putting everything into Amazon, into KDP and Unlimited. What have you seen on your side? Is that the case? Are more people shifting into Amazon only? Is it easier, or is it just a better way to get more readers?
I have seen both ways. I have some friends that are involved in Unlimited, and they do the KDP Select program. And they've had some really good success there. They've built a really good audience. They're able to offer their readers some good value that way, and it works for them. On the flip side, I, as well as some other authors that I'm close to, do diversify. For me, I just have always, kind of from the get-go, have been on multiple platforms. And I do well enough, and I think I reach enough people on all those various platforms that I want to continue to, you know, at least as long as it seems like I'm reaching people and that people want my books there, I want to continue to offer them that way. I think Now, if I'm looking at this from the business perspective, and so if I were standing in Amazon's business offices, I think it benefits the big giants like Amazon, as well as, you know, some of the smaller readers. I think it benefits them all from having people on multiple platforms, because of the marketing side in me thinks it's good to see a cover here, but maybe you buy it there, or you see a cover here and you buy it over there. I think the more people you can reach, I always think that's a good thing. But I have some friends that have been very successful on the other side of things. So I think you kind of got to find what works for you. You figure it out pretty quickly. If something's making zero money,
right?
You can kind of cut that one off.
Do you worry that you could be reaching more readers if you had gone Amazon exclusive and then into their unlimited program?
I don't need more. There was a time when I thought, boy, maybe I should do all of this, but I had enough readers that I didn't want to abandon in other places. And so I just thought, no, you know what? I'm doing good enough. I'm happy here. I'll kind of ride this out. But Amazon has some really amazing marketing tools. And I can understand wanting to take advantage of them. And, you know, perhaps I will do that with one book one day or maybe down the road. But, I don't have regrets. Not right now. Ask me in a year. We'll see.
I tell you, it changes so frequently and so drastically that I could ask you in 6 months and it might be different.
Yeah, right. This is true. Yeah, we've seen some changes in subscription programs and how things work. It's the reading market is fickle.
It is. Who or what influenced you into becoming a writer? Was it a teacher or a book you had read or a specific author?
This is actually my favorite story to tell. when I get asked to speak at a lot of high schools in the Valley here in Arizona, and I love sharing this with them. When I was a little girl, so I'm going to say, you know, probably around 8 or 9, I did a lot of reading in my library. And I was all about Judy Blume, and I read Super Fudge, and I loved Judy Blume books like I loved Air and Ice Cream. And my library did this really cool thing where they let you come in and film a video book report. So I went in and filmed my video book report, and apparently I was the first kid to get to do this. So the newspaper sent out a reporter, and she did a little story on me and doing this book report. And she had a notebook, and she had a really cool pen. And I remember thinking, that is the coolest pen. And I love how she holds that pen. And I started to think, that is like a neat job. Wow. So, like, you can actually write for a living. And here I was, I loved reading and I loved her cool pen. And so I kind of put it together and after investigating a little with my dad, what kind of job is that woman had, and decided, you know, journalism might be a good route. So here I am, this precocious little 8-year-old who already has her whole life mapped out that she's going to go to ASU and study journalism. And then I become 12 and I pick up in a Goodwill, Judy Blume's Forever, because I read Judy Blume and hey, it's a young adult Judy Blume novel. I've got to read that. And I brought it home and there was sex and swearing in it. And the kids were going through the exact same things I was going through. And it was, about feeling uncomfortable in your own skin and about wanting attention and maybe growing up too fast and first times. And first of all, I hid it from my parents because I thought, oh my God, they're going to take this away if they know I'm reading it, which I know now they wouldn't have. But I could not believe that a book could make me feel like that. And it locked this little idea in my head that that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to write a book like that. And I think on many levels that is why I write the genres that I write. And that's probably the seed for me wanting to create the things that I have created so far.
You mentioned that you speak to high schools. What brings you into the high school arena?
Was because one of my former teachers, when I was in high school, sent me an email and said that he was really proud of what I'd done and that he had an advanced reading group that they did kind of a book club type thing. And he would love to sponsor one of my books for a read and have me in to talk to them. And I thought, that is the coolest thing ever. And so I said yes. And I actually ordered some of my books for the students and we brought them in and they all had read them. And I went in and we had book club for about an hour and a half and I answered their questions and we talked about, you know, writing and why I think it's a good career and opportunities in writing. my book, the choices I made in the book, how the book made them feel. And it was one of the best days of my life. It was a teacher that had always believed in me, and it was just kind of a really great moment. And then he had me back the following year. And I've since been back in that school for a couple of their career days. I've really connected with a lot of the students on my social media, and it's exciting to see them excited about reading and maybe sharing other books that they're reading with me. And then once one school heard I had done that, I was contacted by a teacher that asked me, would you like to come talk to my school? And it's just sort of grown from there. And I've had a few now contact me and have me out. And it's something that I love. And I think mostly because I would have loved to have Judy Blume come into my school when I was a kid. It would have made my day. Not that I'm Judy Blume, but I'm working on it. So
you'll get there.
I've got some years left. So
do you know if any of your students have gone on to write their own stories or publish their own?
You know, I know a few of them want to write, and I encourage them to. There are definitely some that I have talked to that, and they'll ask the best questions, because they'll ask about things they should read to get craft ideas from. And none that I know of yet, but I know that they still have that passion there, and I love knowing that.
That's terrific. Is there a character from a book you wish you had written?
A character from a book.
I ask this question of everybody. I'm always interested to hear what people say.
You know, it's funny because I actually have an answer.
Okay.
I do have an answer. And your timing is amazing. When I was gearing up for the release of Wicked Restless, the one that just came out, I actually had a blogger that had read and reviewed the book in advance for me. And she sent me a note that Wicked Restless had that outsider's feeling to it. And I got really excited because I love Pony Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And the outsiders for me, whereas a lot of people that I went to 7th and 8th grade with, I know that they rolled their eyes and they hated writing that essay. But oh my God, I loved that book, and I loved writing the essay, and I loved writing about the family and Dally and the Soaks and the Greasers. And I could probably give you the Cliff's note on that entire book and eat up the rest of the show. But yeah, I think Ponyboy is a great character because I think he kind of paved the way for a male voice like that, and one that was okay with feeling things and wanting things. And maybe in some ways that's how I pattern my bad boys, because they all kind of have that Ponyboy chewy center in the middle,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense. So yeah, I think I have some envy there of Ponyboy.
Interesting. Okay, that's the first time I think someone's mentioned The Outsiders.
Ah.
Today's episode is brought to you by FeedPress, a simple, intuitive, and powerful RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform. FeedPress is made for bloggers and podcasters. Featuring powerful subscriber and podcast download tracking, integrated newsletters, automated publishing to popular social networks such as Twitter and Facebook, a slick drag-and-drop podcast hosting interface, and everything you need in order to submit an optimized feed to iTunes. With 250 megabytes of flexible file storage that rolls over monthly, you can easily upload 4 episodes per month. Upgrading storage is easy and affordable, starting at a flat rate of just $20 for 1 gigabyte. Let's face it, you've probably thought about moving from the aging feed burner. FeedPress offers an automatic migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Answer a few simple questions and the rest is taken care of. Your feeds and subscriber data will be transitioned into your FeedPress account, leaving you free to focus on what you do best, making content. Now is the perfect time to have all of your analytics and podcast hosting in a beautiful and unified dashboard. FeedPress offers free migration assistance and will take care of the hard work for you. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via email. Get in touch and they can help. FeedPress now serves more than 30 million requests per month and is trusted by such popular blogs and podcasting networks as ESN, Mule Radio, Unprofessional, The New Disruptors, Beautiful Pixels, Inessential, MacGasm, The Brooks Review, 512 Pixels, and of course, Covered. Sign up today and try FeedPress for a 14-day trial, no contracts or commitments. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. That's promo code COVERED, COVERED,
Our thanks to FeedPress for sponsoring this episode of Covered.
Where do you see your career going in the future? Do you you had mentioned becoming a hybrid author. Do you foresee signings in Barnes and Nobles? Do you foresee book tours or anything like that?
I would love that. When I sit down and, you know, it's, you know, along with that fantasy of winning the lottery, that certainly is also a fantasy that goes through my head. I also have this fantasy that Drew Barrymore sees my book one day and makes it into a movie. So
nice.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to dream big, right? So I would love that. But that said, I'm also incredibly just happy and I feel blessed that I'm able to do what I do. And if this were it for me, if I had hit a ceiling and I just had to coast at where I'm at, I think I would be absolutely okay with that. It doesn't mean I don't want more or I wouldn't love more. I wouldn't love to have throngs and lines of people outside of a Barnes and Noble, probably not in Phoenix because it's too hot to wait outside here waiting for me. I would love that. But I'm also pretty content.
Are you able to subsist on your income from writing right now? Is this what you're doing for a living?
It is. It Excellent. Is. I've been able to subsist on writing for almost 2 years now, which...
Fantastic.
You would think meant I was sleeping more, but somehow I've just stretched the writing hours. So now they not only include late at night, they also include the daytime. So...
It's interesting because you, for all intents and purposes, you work for yourself. So you're setting your own deadlines. You don't Yeah. have an editor breathing down your neck. You don't have an agent breathing down your neck saying, we got to get this out. You know, Right. you're going to be up till 2 a.m. So you impose those deadlines on yourself and you write until the wee hours of the morning.
I set goals for myself. I certainly set goals, but I kind of want to always deliver something for my readers. And so I try to always give them something for me to look forward to. Something realistic. I have fellow author friends who I have no idea. I think maybe they have cloned themselves and they have like a workshop somewhere where they crank out books, where they're able to write literally 10 books a year. I have been able to put out about 4 a year. This year it was 3. And that was, you know, that's a lot for me. I think that's good.
That sounds like a lot for anybody. I write a book every year and a half, and I don't know how anybody can write more than 2 or 3 books a year.
I also know people that can crank them out, you know, a book a month. And that is an amazing gift, one that I don't have. But I think I'm able to work that quickly, probably because of the journalism background, and I'm used to editors standing on desks and yelling at me to go get the story. So a certain sense of urgency, I guess.
In your book, you pay very close attention to the prose that you write, more so than others, I'd argue. Do you worry that if you did try to crank out more books a year or that you tried to increase your productivity, that quality would falter?
I definitely worry about it. For me, it would. Again, I know lots of authors who can put out that much and every single book is of their quality, and it's, you know, and it's a wonderful story. And I think, how do you do it? You must be cloned. I don't know how you do it. But for me, it would definitely compromise something. And I know that limit about myself, so I respect it. So I'm envious of those who don't have that limit, but this is working for me. So I'm going to stick with that pace.
Do you ever go back to your first book and say, man, what was I thinking publishing this? Because the one that you've just published is so much better? Or where do you stand on the quality of your writing as you've gone through this?
I definitely have seen improvement in my writing. The one thing I definitely have felt is I think I'm more confident. So I don't second guess things. I know what I want to say. I know what threads I'm going to weave in the story, and I don't shy away from them. That said, and maybe because I carried that book around for so long, my first book is in very many ways the story I always wanted to tell. It is coming of age, and it is about a tomboy, and it's about a girl who grows up with a boy's name. Her name is Nolan. And the people that have read that book, and I have people that have actually found me by reading that book first, there's a special connection there with them in that book being the one that they found. And I think because it was so precious and important to me. So I feel pretty darn proud of it. I wish I could have sent it off with a bigger splash, but I did the best I could.
What do you want aspiring writers and authors to take away from this conversation? What do you want them to know?
I hope people can lose the fear. That's probably my biggest regret, is that I let fear dictate going for this for so long. And, you know, and I instead kept up with the practical work that paid the bills. And I think that there are so many opportunities out there now and ways to try to find an audience and to do what you love that you got to try. And if I could, you know, travel back in time and tell my younger self to go ahead and try, maybe I would believe myself and actually try. But yeah, there's just no room for fear. Even those of us that are terrified of rejection in the publishing world, even if it's self-publishing, if you want it bad enough, you've got to try.
Ginger, thank you so much for coming on today. This has been great.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Where can people find you online?
Well, I am available on all e-retailers. So on Amazon, iBooks, Google, BarnesandNoble.com, Kobo, Smashwords. And if you go to Smashwords, there's probably a few more retailers that you can find on there. Yeah.
This has been Covered with special guest Ginger Scott. Her book, Wicked Restless, is available wherever fine ebooks are sold. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't already, please leave us a review on iTunes. It's the best way for other book lovers to find us. We also have a Patreon page at patreon.com/covered, so fans can contribute to the podcast's production. We have some great perks lined up for our patrons, so please consider supporting our show with any amount you can. And thank you again to Feed Press and Knocked Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.